loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll talk to our producer, Walter Smolarek, who's on the ground in Quebec City at the G7 summit. We'll hear from protesters that he's interviewed and legal observers who are there as well. And then, in our second half hour, our regular Friday segment with Lukeman Nation is coming up right after that. Get Jackie's thoughtful and unique takes on the raft of primary races this week. We'll talk about whether the Democrats' millions of dollars investment got them what they needed, whether people continued to uphold the Bernie agenda, and where we'll see the midterm season take us from here. Stay tuned for this important political coverage in our second half hour.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Google has been reeling from an employee protest over the use of artificial intelligence for military purposes. So CEO Sundar Pichai told employees yesterday that the company will not use AI for weapons or for surveillance that violates human rights. Google will continue to work with governments and with the military, though. Next, the FBI yesterday arrested James Wolfe, the recently retired director of security for the Senate Intelligence Committee. He was charged with three felony counts of making a false statement. Wolf is under further investigation for revealing classified information to a reporter with whom he had a personal relationship, Ali Watkins of the New York Times. More troubling is the revelation that the FBI seized several years' worth of Watkins and Wolf's electronic communications. Then the trials of J20 protesters continued this week in Washington, but with repeated setbacks for the prosecution. Yesterday, four defendants were either acquitted on all charges or acquitted on some, and the jury deadlocked on others. The U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia will have to decide whether to retry on those counts. But so far, this has been nothing but a black eye for the government. And then Brazil took another step into privatization yesterday when they auctioned off some of their nation's oil fields. This is just days after truckers in Brazil ended their 10-day strike over fuel prices, increasing the chaos under Temer's rule since the parliamentary coup 2 years ago.
And in other headlines, Friday demonstrations in Gaza have continued and Israeli forces show no signs of letting up, with more than 500 protesters injured and at least three killed. The IDF military has been driving through the crowds with jeeps today to try to break up groups, as well as firing tear gas at the protesters. One of the people killed by Israelis was a 15-year-old named Hatham al-Jamal. Special Counsel Robert Mueller filed a new superseding indictment against Paul Manafort and Konstantin Kilimnik today for charges of conspiracy to obstruct justice and obstruction of justice. Manafort's remaining charges remain unchanged. Donald Trump said today that he, quote, probably will end up supporting, unquote, the bipartisan bill that's been introduced in Congress to prevent the Department of Justice from interfering or making arrests in states that have legalized marijuana use. This position is in direct contrast to his own attorney general and head of the Department of Justice, Jeff Sessions, further highlighting rifts between him and his administration. The International Criminal Court overturned the conviction of Jean-Pierre Bemba, the former vice president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The ICC said that he could not be held to account for crimes that others carried out without his knowledge, and that the prior judges did not account for his work to stop those war crimes once he did have knowledge of them. Those are today's headlines. Next up is our reporter on the ground in Quebec City at the G7 summit.
Loud and clear.
Now we turn to the G7 summit. President Trump showed no signs of compromise on trade issues as he left for the G7 summit in Canada this morning. In fact, he got into a Twitter war over tariffs with French President Emmanuel Macron and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau even before he left Washington. The president also will skip the climate portion of the summit to travel to Singapore for his meeting with Kim Jong-un. We're joined from Quebec City by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek, who also interviewed some protesters last night who we'll hear from. And then later we'll be joined by Alex Neve, Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada. Welcome, Walter.
Good to be here.
So what are you seeing now? You're in Quebec City, you're interviewing, you're talking to protesters. How were all the protests last night? Tell us what happened.
Yeah, that's right. And right now I'm standing here at Place Duville, where the second set of demonstrations today is likely to take place. So earlier today I was at another demonstration that was a little bit outside of Quebec City. The G7 leaders are meeting at a resort that's pretty far outside of the city. And so there was a demonstration that briefly shut down the highway that led to the resort. Now there's a relatively small gathering going on in the middle of Quebec City itself. But last night's demonstration was much larger. It was, approximately 500 people, very spirited, very high energy. There was a very, very significant mobilization of heavily armed riot police that were, shadowing the demonstration, trying to encircle it at different points. Who have come out into the streets are outraged about the G7, basically the system that the G7 represents, one in which, a handful of extremely wealthy nations and extremely wealthy individuals and corporations are able to exercise a huge amount of influence over world events. And the G7 summit is sort of the venue in which they manage their system.
I'm glad you brought up the point of the G7 summit, because I think you may have heard this morning that Trump's comments, he said we should add Russia back into the G7.
It's very interesting, and I suspect that it's kind of an off-the-cuff thing. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's something that's particularly consistent with the foreign policy that the Trump administration is following, which is, I think harsher than any U.S. administration since the end of the Cold War. This question of Russia's inclusion or exclusion from the G7 summit is a very interesting one, and sort of gets to the heart of post-Soviet Russian history. On what basis will Russia, which is this, relatively new entity, the Russian Federation, that was established in the early 1990s, what role will it play in the world? And so for the first 10 years of Russian, post-Soviet history, from 1990 until, approximately 2000, under the leadership of Boris Yeltsin, Russia, was on its way to being reintegrated into the world capitalist economy, I think on the basis basically of being a neo-colony, where, the assets, the natural resources of the country would be stripped away and sold off to private corporations, many of which are based in the West, and a sort of gangsterism ruled, right? So, that you had oligarchs operating private, armies in some cases. Ever since, approximately 2000, I mean, really, this is what the presidency of Vladimir Putin was about, that, Russia became a more normal capitalist country, right? It has a lot of natural resources. It has a developed economy. And so it began to assert itself more on the world stage, and that set it on a collision course with the other members of the G7, those that did not want to see sort of a resurgent Russia on the world stage. They were excluded. The G8 became the G7. Now Donald Trump is going to be raising this whole controversy over again, it seems.
Walter, what exactly are the G7 nations expecting to accomplish there? Donald Trump has been fighting them for days, and he's going to leave early. He's going to skip the climate portion. They're at loggerheads over trade. What do you think is going to be accomplished at the end of this thing?
Well, I don't think anything very much will be accomplished, although I think some important political dynamics might become more pronounced. Certainly the main event of the summit is the dispute over trade between the Donald Trump administration and the rest of the G7 countries, who are more ideologically or politically committed to the sort of traditional neoliberal free trade arrangement, where there's very minimal, if any, restrictions on the abilities of companies to trade, whatever commodities they want, wherever they want. That's not to say that, Donald Trump's tariffs are really about helping working class or middle class people or whatever. But, it is a pretty fundamental dispute. And so the rift between the United States and especially with the European countries, who feel personally offended, I think, in a lot of ways by the decision of the U.S. government, which counts them as, their traditional and strongest allies, to go after their some very important economic interests. I think that rift will intensify, and perhaps we'll start seeing the other G7 countries, the G6, as some media reports are calling them now, begin to coordinate more amongst themselves and perhaps exclude the United States, at least as long as Trump is in office, from some of the more important political discussions and decision making.
Actually, that's where I was going to go with this. So do you see the United States being cut out essentially of the G7, or at least cut out of G7 decision making?
Well, I'm not sure if it'll go that far. I think that it may, have some its influence will be in an informal way diminished. I believe that's true. But the United States still holds some very important cards. I mean, one is that the U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency. The United States has, you know, is home to some of the most powerful corporations in the world, especially financial interests, which is the lifeblood of the modern economy. The U.S. military, I think, is the fundamental anchor of the Western-dominated world order that prevails right now. And so these cards and, you know, these points of leverage for the United States government still exist. And I think that's why we've seen a strong trend in, you know, places like Germany, France, the U.K., not really to go too hard against the Trump administration. I mean, rhetorically, you know, they might make some mildly tough statements. I mean, you know, the mainstream media made a big deal about Justin Trudeau saying that, oh, these tariffs are unacceptable. So they may sort of rhetorically say, hey, this is really not okay with us. But in terms of concrete actions that really, really make the United States pay a cost for imposing these trade measures, I think we are yet to see that. It might actually not happen. They may just be sort of blustering and bluffing, but unable to truly take decisive action as a consequence of the anchoring role that the United States plays in the world system.
I wonder what role personality is going to play in all of this, too, because Donald Trump's not afraid of picking a fight with major world leaders, whether it's in person, face to face, or over Twitter. And I think this is something that's going to have a real impact on policy, whether it's trade or defense or the environment or any host of things. Something that I think bears watching.
So, Walter, I know that trade is for sure going to be a big part of this meeting over the next couple of days. What about the Iran nuclear deal? I mean, especially many of our allies in Europe were extremely upset and were pushing Trump, even with, you know, personal visits to try to get him to stay in the JCPOA. Do you think that'll play a major role today?
Well, I think it's definitely an important point of disunity. You know, if we're talking about the big trend lines that could lead to a break among the G7 countries that have been traditionally so close to each other in world politics and geopolitics, you know, the Iran nuclear deal is certainly one of those things. You know, the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, is often talked about in the U.S. media as though it were a bilateral agreement between the United States and Iran, or at least politicians sometimes talk about it that way. But that's not true. It was an agreement between the five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, plus Germany and Iran, on the other hand. So, you know, this is a legally binding international treaty that the United States is in willful violation of. I mean, it's clear the International Atomic Energy Agency, you know, all, you know, mildly unbiased observers will say that Iran has been completely compliant with the stipulations of the nuclear deal. But Donald Trump, because of his, you know, extreme hostility to Iran and the hostility of members of his administration to Iran, have decided to pull out just because they want to impose new additional onerous terms that, of course, Iran will not agree to. And so the corporations based in France, in the UK, and in Germany, you know, they're we're looking forward to doing business with Iran, which is a very, very large market. You know, it's a large economy. People have, you know, a relatively high level of purchasing power. And following the agreement of the deal, you know, the signing of the deal in 2015, they had made arrangements to invest in certain ventures in Iran, and they stand to lose out of a considerable amount of money because of the new sanctions that the United States have announced. And so the leaders are unhappy about that.
Walter, we're going to go to a couple of clips, some very interesting interviews that you've done. We want our listeners to hear them as well.
So we're here in Parc des Braves, ahead of the first big demonstration against the G7. So could you tell me your name?
Dave.
And Dave, why are you out here to protest today?
G7 should no longer exist because, we're no longer in the 70s. Right now, here in Quebec, we voted very strict rules about lobbyism. And so those kind of summits are like outside the spirit of the law we've given ourselves as a nation. It's kind of a supranational thing that's gonna take over the state. And I don't like it.
And what are the main issues with the G7? Is it the environment? Is it globalization?
State sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of dictatorship disguised as investors' protection. Well, I'm talking more about those free trade agreements and whatever, but the G7 is what they use to negotiate. So, that's pretty much it.
Yeah. I've noticed, of course, a ton of police officers here. They're all in riot gear, at least a lot of them are. Do you think that the cops are going to respect people's right to assemble?
I don't think so. They have to rentabilize all those resources. So if things going to get bad by themselves, they're very able to provoke it. And there's a lot of precedents here in Quebec and in Canada. Let's think about Toronto or Montebello or Montreal. Just a few examples.
It's that on a daily basis, throughout the world, collectives organize themselves to dream and create alternatives to capitalism. May we be opposed to the construction of a pipeline or the opening of a mine. May we defend an ancestral territory or fight to slow down gentrification. We construct day-to-day urban and rural communities of resistance that drive away from capitalist and binary structures.
What do you say to people who are worried about violence related to these protests?
The only violence that we are denouncing is the violence from the G7 members, so from their neoliberal policies.
What about violence that could happen in these protests? Because often they degenerate.
We will not condemn acts that have not been yet done, actually.
Are you encouraging peaceful protests?
Actually, we are here to protest, and we are here to denounce the violence from the neoliberal policies of the G7 members.
Can you say your name and your organization, please?
Okay, my name is Maud Trudel, and I'm with no organization at all. I'm here alone.
And why did you come to the protest today?
Well, I came here because I'm totally against reunions like G7 that only... I'm against those reunions where people of great power decide for the future of everybody, while the population that actually vote for them have absolutely no other thing to say than just vote for them for every 4 years. And it's totally ridiculous that they're going to decide for environmental laws, for economics and everything without us having anything to say about it. So that's pretty ridiculous.
There are a very large number of police here. They appear to be pretty heavily armed. Are you concerned that there might be clashes, that the police may not allow the demonstration to proceed?
I have no idea. It depends on how the crowd goes. It depends on how the police tolerates the manifestation. Usually it's when the police says it's illegal that it gets really worse, usually, because then people get mad. They tell people to leave, and then they get mad, and then it's where it fucks up. But I don't know. People are pretty cool today. I think it's going to be all right.
And I've seen a lot of signs about the Trans Mountain Pipeline and the environmental destruction that could bring about. Can you talk a little bit about that? How are people reacting to Prime Minister Trudeau's decision to bail out the pipeline?
Yeah, people are really mad, you know, because he was elected. People were thinking he was really going to be progressive for the environment, and then he just comes here and just does like everybody, every other prime minister in the history of Canada, just doing whatever idiots say, and I don't know. Yeah, people are mad.
And now we're joined by Alex Neave. He's the Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada. Alex, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So I know Amnesty International is there in Quebec City providing legal observers and watching out for civil liberties. Can you tell us what you've observed so far?
So Amnesty International has joined up with the main civil liberties organization here in the province of Quebec, La Ligue des Droits et Libertés. And we've done this because we want to, as best we can, make a contribution to preventing violations of freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, those really important rights associated with protest. And things are only just getting going. So there were some initial protests yesterday, not a large number, and the protests weren't of a significant number of participants. And we so far have not seen serious concerns that we've documented. There certainly were a small number of people who were arrested. and we're following up now. We do have access to the detention centers where they're held to see if we can clarify the reasons and circumstances, but it seems that that may only be about five or six people at this point. But it's over the course of today and tomorrow that the numbers of demonstrators are expected to grow and where we will obviously be watching very closely to make sure there's no abuses.
Alex, tell us a little bit about the police presence, what it looks like. You know, here in the United States, we have transitioned into this almost paramilitary situation with our police departments. Is that what you're seeing in Canada right now?
Well, we're not supposed to be seeing that. In fact, Amnesty International and the Civil Liberties League both had extensive meetings with police forces and government officials in the lead up to this, talking about, amongst other things, that very concern that we didn't want to see these protests met with a heavy militarized response using tactics that might involve lethal weaponry, that would involve mass arrests, because we've seen some of that in previous arrests going back to 2012 in Montreal, 2010 in Toronto. And we were assured that lessons have been learned and that that isn't the approach that's going to be used. Police forces received a lot of criticism because of how they handled things in the past. But we were troubled yesterday to see that, for instance, in areas where protesters are gathering, that yes, there were police there with less than lethal weaponry. But then we looked over just a little bit over to the side and we could see that there were also police there with assault weapons. They're saying that's there in case, you know, some sort of security incident was suddenly to happen and they need to be ready. We were a bit concerned about how intermingled it seemed to be and are going to be watching for those sorts of things very closely. So theoretically, we should be seeing a different kind of policing this time around. I think the proof will really start to play out today and tomorrow when things pick up.
How long has Amnesty monitored the G7 that has happened? Is that something that you all have monitored worldwide, wherever they're meeting?
And not necessarily consistently every time and in every country. I guess I certainly could speak mainly for the Canadian context. We have been involved. We had a very significant monitoring presence out on the ground in Calgary back in 2002 when the G7 was held in Calgary and Kananaskis. We also were present. We had quite a number of Amnesty members, some doing observation work, others simply participating in the demonstrations when the G8 and G20 were held in Toronto in 2010. But I would say this mission that has been put together here in Quebec City this time, this partnership with the Civil Liberties Group here in Quebec, is the most involved and comprehensive. And it's because here in Quebec, and Quebec City even in particular, there's a history around which there's a lot of sensitivity as to how protests get handled. There were the student protests that were handled very poorly in 2012. Some listeners may recall back in 2001, there were infamous protests very badly handled by the police associated with what was known as the Summit of the Americas. And so because of that history, there was a real impulse to put something significant on the ground.
Tell us also what kind of charges people who are being arrested might face. Here in Washington, we have an ongoing trial of demonstrators from Inauguration Day who were charged with felony rioting. And it's a very heavy charge. It carries a long prison sentence. They've beaten those charges so far, but still there are something like 47 or 49 people awaiting trial. What are these protesters facing in Canada?
Well, we don't know yet. As I said, there's only been a handful arrested this time around, and we'll see what charges, if any, they face and whether there are more to come today and tomorrow. In general, now we don't have anything readily that I'm aware of that would be the equivalent to what you've just described, felony rioting. Generally, people arrested in this kind of context are facing charges like public mischief. If there are acts of violence, then clearly that may take it into something more serious, in particular if there was any physical violence. But it's usually those sorts of charges that people face. But we'll have to wait and see what happens in this context.
I know that some of the protests that will be going on are specifically environmental, and we know that President Trump will not be staying for the climate portion of these conversations. Are there, have you heard anything about that protest in particular, and are there other protests that you're expecting?
Well, certainly the protest around environmental and climate change concerns is one around which I think there's a lot of energy and creativity coming together, and I can only imagine that President Trump and his well-known views around global efforts to tackle climate change, and I think the disdain people feel that is demonstrated by his early departure from the summit at that stage will be a focus of those demonstrations. There certainly will be a range of issues. I think people understand and expect that in these sorts of contexts where there's a big global summit, many leaders, many issues on people's minds, there will be protesters out talking about, you know, global militarization and the arms trade and peace and disarmament. There will certainly, I would expect, be a lot of demonstrators out focusing on gender equality and women's human rights, which is the theme, after all, that the Canadian government is trying to make the priority of the official summit. And there may well be protesters who are highlighting situations in particular parts of the world, the situation in North Korea, Israel, Gaza, Syria, Yemen, those kinds of situations very much on people's minds. This is an opportunity. We've got seven of the world's most important leaders here in the country, and people will want to have their say.
Are you expecting any kind of Canadian-specific protests after Trump has kind of treated its longtime ally of Canada a little bit poorly in the past few months?
I can only imagine that many of the protesters will probably have some choice signs and messages for President Trump as they head out into the streets. I think this latest round this past week of what's happened with respect to our trading relationship and these absurd notions that the U.S. economy needs to view the Canadian economy as a national security threat have clearly incensed people. But I think the protesters are more likely to be focusing on other issues related to the Trump presidency, less on the trade agenda. So things like the various versions of the Muslim ban and the ongoing plans for the wall along the border with Mexico, and how refugees and immigrants have been treated in the country, and the rollback on sexual and reproductive rights and moves against transgender individuals and all of those kinds of concerns. I would imagine there will be quite a multitude of messages for President Trump.
Absolutely. There's a lot to talk about there, for sure. Well, we've been joined by Quebec City by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek, who has also interviewed some protesters last night who we heard from. And then we've also heard here from Alex Neve, Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada. We're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer went out on a limb this week and said the Democrats would retake the Senate in this year's election. That's a bold statement, with five endangered Democrats and only two endangered Republicans. And how many Democrats considering a run for president can you name? Have you ever heard of John Delaney or Howard Schultz? We're joined here in the studio by Jacqueline Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. And you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 o'clock p.m. on Facebook. Jackie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So first off, Chuck Schumer, I understand that the man's job is to talk up the Democrats, but he really did go out on a limb this week by saying that the Democrats have a shot at actually winning back the Senate. There are something like, three quarters of the races are Democratic incumbents right now, and five of them, I might even say six of them, are endangered. So he's saying that they can win all of those seats and flip two Republican seats or three Republican seats. What do you think of that?
I think he's doing a great job as a PR person, I guess, but that's all he's doing. That is not the reality of the situation. And if California is any indication of the chances the Democrats have in taking back the House or the Senate, nobody can call this right now. Nobody can sit there and prevaricate and say this definitely is going to go one way or the other.
Politico said that that privately, Democrats are saying that really only four of their incumbents are endangered. That's Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Bill Nelson of Florida, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, and Claire McCaskill of Missouri. And they say that even Mitch McConnell has omitted Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin from the list of GOP targets because the Democrats are strong there and the Republicans were unable to recruit a decent candidate. Would you agree with that? And what about West Virginia?
I think that for both parties, they've got branding and recruitment and turnout problems, but for different reasons.
That's a good point.
And that's why when I'm just looking at the primary results from Tuesday, that's why I'm wondering where he's getting, where Schultz is getting his optimism from, because I understand that turnout is low in primaries, but we're talking about the so-called resistance against Trump. This is the era of the Trump resistance. And in California, the turnout was less than 20% for Democrats.
Yeah, it
for
was.
For Democrats.
That's right.
And it's been low pretty much across the board. So I don't know how the Democrats are going to, maybe they'll hold on to some seats just because, you know, diehard Democratic voters are going to come out enough. Are going to come out to vote for the incumbent Democrats, and they're going to hope that Republicans don't come out as much. But they're not generating any kind of enthusiasm at the polls for any of these people.
Let me ask you about that, too. Let's say Schumer's right, that the Democrats are able to hold on to these seats. They still need to flip three Republican seats. So think of Arizona with Jeff Flake's retirement. Nevada with Dean Heller, he's the weakest one. But they would also have to win in Tennessee, which is Bob Corker's seat.
Which is not going to happen.
We're talking about eight different things all falling into place.
Exactly. And that's not going to happen. I think the Democrats will hold on to the seats they have, but I don't see them flipping most of these seats. They may flip one, but I don't think all of these, I don't think the stars are going to align for the Democrats to take back the Senate.
I don't think so either.
I think that's his prediction is really a prayer.
And nobody's talking about Montana. I think John Tester's in trouble. And I think that if there's going to be any real surprise on election night, it's going to be in Montana.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think agree.
That's the case. Well, I also wanted to talk to you about California. So much happened in California on Tuesday with this primary. You know, we've talked in the past about this very odd primary system that they have, where people of both parties run in the same race, and then whoever the top two vote getters are, and frequently they're members of the same party, run in the general elections. You can have two Democrats in the general running against each other, two Republicans, or a Democrat and a Republican. How did things turn out?
This is where the voter turnout was really shocking for the Democrats, because they were very afraid that they were going to be locked out of the general election. They were afraid that the Republicans were going to garner enough votes to push their top two to the top of the field instead of the Democrats, because there were so many Democrats running. So they thought Democrats would dilute all these votes.
There were 31 Democrats running against Dianne Feinstein.
And it's interesting that Feinstein, with 31 competitors, got 40% of the vote.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
But then again, we're only talking about a 13 to 15% registered voter turnout among Democrats. So while, you know, people are looking at that and saying, well, Dianne Feinstein coasted to coasted to winning the winning that election, we're not talking about a whole lot of people who came out to vote. And I think Democrats are making a mistake by chalking that up to voter apathy. That's a huge mistake. This is not voter apathy.
Very important
this
point.
This is voter disillusionment.
Mm-hmm.
This is disillusionment among voters. I think there is some truth to the fact that when you have such a saturated field, nobody knows the 31 candidates. And California's ballot was really complicated. And they have down ballot races for everything.
Yeah, they do.
You know, so people, it's a really complex voting system that people are just tired of, first of all. And then you have all of these candidates who have no money, who aren't campaigning, who people don't know anything about. So the only person they know is Dianne Feinstein.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So she won basically by virtue of name recognition.
She's been around forever. She was the mayor of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
She She was considered as a potential gubernatorial candidate for decades, and she's been in the Senate forever.
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin DeLeon, who's the president of the California State Senate, was supposed to be the one candidate who could knock off Feinstein. He actually made it into the runoff, but he only ended up with something like 20%.
Exactly.
So and is he a serious contender for this seat?
He is not a serious contender for this seat. And aside from the name recognition that Feinstein got, the reason he's not a serious contender was because the Democratic Party did not really support him, even though they didn't endorse Feinstein.
Right.
Now, this is where we thought there was going to be some real change in California.
We talked about this months ago.
Yes, because the Democratic Party in California refused to endorse Feinstein.
Right.
But they just barely sort of tepidly endorsed kind of maybe not DeLeon.
Right.
But they didn't get behind him. They didn't campaign for him. They didn't really give him any money.
No. And interestingly, his name recognition levels never changed.
Right.
Even after the state convention.
Exactly. And I really feel, because I have so much distrust for the Democratic Party, I really feel that they knew this was going to happen. That they, them not endorsing Feinstein was a message to her.
Sure it was. It was a message to her to mm-hmm. move to the left.
Yes. Yes.
And she received the message.
Right.
And she moved to the left.
Right. And they had no intention of supporting anybody else but her.
I agree.
Anyway. So, you know, what it looks like for now is that Dianne Feinstein will keep her seat.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, but when we're looking at the other races in California, we have to remember, because I don't think people realize that California is not a blue state. Not really. California has cities, major cities that are blue, and they are surrounded by suburbs and exurbs that are very red.
Yes.
So a lot of these races in these other districts in California are not as clear cut blue. There is no blue wave in California.
Well, it's like this enormous district that Devin Nunes represents outside of Sacramento. It is solidly red.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what Devin Nunes does on Capitol Hill. It doesn't matter if it looks like he's ignoring his constituents. That
right.
district is so Republican
mm-hmm.
that he'll win re-election until he decides he doesn't want the job anymore.
Exactly. So, you know, we've got someone like Feinstein who is well up in age, but she also recognizes that most of her state is red. So a lot of her policies do not appeal to and don't really cover a lot of urban voters. And people in the exurbs recognize that. But again, this is going to be an issue of voter turnout. That's a problem with the Democratic Party.
And that's what the Democrats are counting on in November. The New York Times said this week that the Democrats have a chance to pick up as many as 10 House seats just in California. Now, in a number of those, you have two Democrats running against each other, like in Daryl Issa's seat in suburban San Diego. This has been a long time Republican seat, decades. It's been represented by a Republican. Daryl Issa barely won it 2 years ago, and he was the chairman of the House Government Oversight Committee at the time. He barely won it, and Hillary Clinton carried it for the first time it was carried by a Democrat. Now there are two Democrats running against each other in the general election. The Democrats are going to flip that. They're going to flip a couple more, but they have a chance to pick up 10. And that's almost half of the 23 that the Democrats need to win back control of the House. Now, they're also counting on flipping another 4 or 5 in Pennsylvania. There are races in New Jersey. There are 2 in New Jersey. There are 2 in Minnesota. There's 1 in Iowa. Maybe 1 or 2, maybe, in Florida. Where do they pick up the rest of these seats?
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know where they're seeing it.
No.
I really don't know where they're seeing it when their strategy for supporting the incumbents is really just, we're not Trump.
Yeah.
They're not pushing the progressive candidates who really could make some inroads. I really do believe that some of the progressive candidates could make some inroads into siphoning off some moderate Republican voters.
Yes.
I really do believe they could, but that is not the Democrat strategy. That's not what they want to invest their money in. That's not what they want to invest their future in. And that's why they're struggling. And you mentioned New Jersey. They're putting their money behind Menendez.
Yeah.
And the Democratic voters don't like Menendez. They don't like him.
In fact, in the New Jersey primary on Tuesday, he won like 51 or 52%.
Just barely.
Barely
and
won.
Who was an enormous surprise, who, if she had the backing of the New Jersey Democratic Party, would have won, would have beat Menendez handily, was the progressive, I think she's a newspaper editor. I think Lisa McCormick is her name. 40% of the vote. Nobody knew who she was. She
no
had
money.
No money. She had no backing.
No advertising.
Just on the virtue of the dislike of Menendez.
And we should say Menendez is widely disliked because he's been involved in so many corruption scandals.
Yes.
And was actually charged with several crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, it was a deadlocked jury.
Right.
And
hung jury, and they had to drop the charges eventually.
And they announced, the prosecutor announced that they wouldn't retry him.
Right, right. And the voters, they're tired of corrupt politicians, but the Democratic Party is supporting Menendez. But they would have been, it would have been a much better bet. And I think it would have been a surer win, or at least a better, more competitive race in New Jersey had they backed McCormick.
Yeah.
Because clearly here is someone who has the messaging for policies that at least 40% of the voters who voted in the New Jersey primary, they liked it.
Yeah, they did. They did. I'm going to add one House race to that. I think there's a real chance that the Democrats could win a House seat outside of Tucson, Arizona. This is another seat that has traditionally been Republican. Lots and lots of retirees. And it went for Hillary Clinton by a point or two last time, much to everybody's surprise. But if the Democrats are looking to win nationwide, they're going to have to look to some of these other states that otherwise wouldn't have been competitive, because they're not going to win in the South.
No.
They're not going to win in
No.
the Rocky Mountain states. And they've already won all the seats that they can win in the Northeast.
Yes.
So besides California, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and then a smattering of other seats, they really need to focus. One last point on this issue, and that is Howard Dean was vilified in the 1990s because
mm-hmm.
he supported what the Democrats called a 50-state strategy.
Right.
His idea was to spend millions of dollars building a new Democratic Party a structure
mm-hmm.
in traditionally Republican states. There is no state Democratic Party, for example, in the state of South Dakota. It just
wow.
doesn't exist. There is no state Democratic Party headquarters. They don't have any paid staff. It just doesn't exist. Howard Dean's idea was to spend money building these structures for the party in all 50 states. And the likes of James Carville just beat up on him because they said it was a waste of money and the money should be spent on targeted races. But Howard Dean was right.
He was absolutely right.
Howard Dean was right. You can't win a national election if you don't have a national presence.
Well, that was echoed by Barack Obama, although he was talking about campaigning and the lack of campaigning that Hillary Clinton did in states that she felt were not competitive, or in states that she felt that she was just naturally going to win. And Obama's argument was, he was also right, was you have to campaign in every state.
Every state.
Every state. So I am disturbed. And I think this is where the voter disillusionment comes in with the Democratic
voters. Voters feel ignored.
They're absolutely ignored.
Why should they turn out and support a Democratic candidate when the Democratic Party doesn't support the Democratic candidate?
Absolutely. And we're not talking about a party that is in, or a party apparatus that is hurting for money.
Right.
You know, so it's not as if we can't afford to support these candidates. No, you can. But when there's no one in these states, like you say, in South Dakota and you know, the middle American states, where they'd love to have an option. They'd love to have an alternative, but no one's there with an alternative.
That's right.
So what do the Democrats expect?
And, you know, it wasn't too long ago that there were Democratic senators from places like Oklahoma
right.
and Kansas
exactly.
and Alaska
right.
and Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't see that anymore.
They just don't exist anymore because the Democrats have absolutely conceded those states to the Republicans because the states are not, they're not as populated
right.
as the coastal states. So they literally just don't see that those people are as important and, you know, important enough for them to target their resources on. And whether that's actually the rationale or not, that's how it looks.
Yeah, that's how it looks.
That's how it looks. And that's how those voters feel. So, yeah, they've completely abandoned the Democratic Party that they feel like has abandoned them. And they're happy to vote for anybody but a Democrat, as long as a Democrat shows no interest in engaging them on in what they need. And I honestly can't blame them.
No, I would feel pushed out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really would.
Yeah. It's interesting that you brought up Alabama, brought up the Democrats not winning in the South, because the Alabama race is really frightening to me personally, on a personal level. Now, the incumbent representative, Martha Roby, is fighting for her seat.
Yes.
Because she came out against Donald Trump after the Access Hollywood tapes.
That's
where
right.
Trump, you know, basically bragged about sexually assaulting women.
Yes.
Here's a Republican woman who said, you know, stood up for integrity and decency and said, there's no way I can look at my children and say that I voted for this man. And she is now fighting for her seat in a red state, but she's fighting for her seat because she has some integrity. Now, as
and
an
she
athlete,
may not win that seat.
She probably will lose that seat. And that to me is frightening as a woman voter, as an African-American voter, because how can the Republicans continue to tell me that they're not welcoming and embracing of sexism and racism when you're punishing people in your own party who are standing up against sexism and racism?
So the party of family values.
And you call yourself the party of family values, but people who exhibit integrity in standing up against those things, the voters, the Republican voters, punish those people and support instead people who will support a president who has exhibited sexist tendencies and behaviors, who certainly has a track record of racism. The Charles Blow just published an op-ed in the New York Times reminding people about the Central Park Five.
Right. And even after they were exonerated.
Even after they exonerated, Donald Trump said that even though someone else admitted to the crime, even though it was proven that the New York City police detectives coerced these teenagers into confessing to a crime they didn't commit, he believed they still should have been executed.
He said that, and then he doubled down on it later.
He did. So as a woman voter, as a black voter, how am I supposed to take the Republican Party seriously about their racism, sexism problem when their voters support candidates who have no integrity on these issues, or at least won't stand up against these types of issues, but they punish people who do?
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about the presidency. I counted the other day the number of people who have been talked about in the press as being potential Democratic candidates for president. There were 28 of them.
Really?
Yeah. 28. You can't possibly fit 28 people on a stage. It's hard to fit 14 people on a stage.
Oh, my gosh.
But Politico ran a couple of articles this week that I thought were fascinating. One was a feature story on a Democratic congressman by the name of John Delaney. He's a progressive Democrat from Maryland. Well, this guy not only is running for president, but he has already spent $1 million of his own money to take 11 trips to Iowa and 8 trips to New Hampshire and to buy television advertising time. He envisions himself as the modern day Jimmy Carter, an honest candidate who comes out of nowhere to win it all. Another one is Howard Schultz. I actually like and respect Howard Schultz. Howard Schultz, until a few days ago, was the CEO of Starbucks.
Right.
And
right.
He made Starbucks into a global behemoth.
Yes, he did.
He's also very progressive, and he's not a career politician.
Mm-hmm.
So the talk is that he's going to be the Democratic answer to Donald Trump, the wealthy businessman.
Yeah.
Where do you think this is going in the Democratic Party? And do you think that the Democrats are just going to fall back on old habits and pick a politician, a senator or a governor?
Yes, I do think they're going to pick a politician. I think Delaney is a long, long, long
shot. The longest of
long shots. I mean, he is the longest of long shots.
I'm a political animal, and I barely have ever heard of this guy.
I live in D.C., right across the border from Maryland. I don't know who is. That's more of an indictment on me than it is on any on him and the work he does. But Schultz is a problem. Howard Schultz is a problem because I can see the Democratic Party, if they don't go with a career politician, going with somebody like Howard Schultz.
Right. And that's why there was so much buzz when Oprah Winfrey gave that speech.
Yes. So the problem with Schultz is that a couple of days ago, was it yesterday or a couple of days ago, he came out and said something that was clearly a capitulation to the fiscally conservative right, where he said, you know, Medicare for all is great and free college is great, but how are you going to how are we going to pay for these programs? When leftists or progressives hear these kinds of things, this obviously raises our radar, because we understand that anybody who questions how they're going to pay for social programs, but they don't question how we're going to pay for the $717 billion that the Department of Defense just received, isn't interested in changing anything. They're just pandering to the status quo. They're hoping to get the support of the Republicans that they're going to have to fight for money.
Yeah.
Where there's no need to fight for money. There's plenty of money in the government. So I can see the Democrats, if they don't support a politician, an established politician, supporting someone like Howard Schultz and saying, see, he has progressive bona fides, but he's still sticking to this very establishment Republican light.
Yeah.
Fiscally conservative
line. Kind of a typical corporate CEO.
He's a typical. I mean, he's the CEO of Starbucks. His entire professional career has been focused on how to expand his profit margin and grow his empire. So that's not very different from the Republican fiscal conservatism of how to show growth on paper and cut, you know, and cut costs.
I think that's right. And I'm not sure that the Democratic voters want a corporate CEO to represent their interests, especially progressives. I think that that's a mismatch.
I think it's a terrible mismatch. But I see the Democratic Party falling right back into the same trap from 2016 and supporting a candidate that they believe is a sure win and completely ignoring the will of the Democratic voters. And which is why I'm going to say this, and it hurts my feelings to say it, but I think it's true, which is why Donald Trump is going to win again.
You know, increasingly, I'm hearing that. I'm hearing that a lot more than I ever have before since Donald Trump was first elected. This is something we need to take seriously. Anybody who is opposed to Donald Trump and his policies and presidency ought to take seriously, because the man's got a good chance of winning re-election.
He does. And the problem with the Democratic Party in the 2016 election was they didn't take Trump seriously as a candidate. But there is no way that you cannot take him seriously now. He is president of the United States. However inept or, you know, unintelligent or whatever pejorative you want to use against him, he is president of the United States. And he's not as stupid as people like to paint him.
Oh, not at all.
He's quite savvy. He's media savvy. He knows how to play to his base.
The Democrats have consistently underestimated this guy.
And they still are.
Yes.
If they're actually thinking that they can pin their hopes on an establishment politician or on a corporate CEO, they're still woefully underestimating at least the media savvy and the craftiness of Donald Trump and his base.
Yes.
Because, listen, people will come out and vote for this man because they believe he is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter that his tax plan hasn't actually helped people.
Right.
It doesn't matter that his tax plan may have saved someone, $30 a year, and this lady was able to get a Costco membership.
Right.
And listen, we can laugh at that, but if people like that believe that's important to them and that matters, then why would we not take that seriously as something that we have to combat as a political strategy. And by combat, I don't mean denigrating those people. I mean explaining to those people why that's crumbs, that's chump change, and you shouldn't be happy with that.
Yes, you're exactly right. We have less than 1 minute left.
There's never enough time.
I know there never is. There are a couple of things I wanted to talk about. We don't have time, but I want to talk for one more minute about this guy, John Delaney, this congressman from Maryland. He made a fortune founding two commercial lending companies. And so he's got tens of millions of dollars. I mentioned a few minutes ago that he's spent already $1 million from his own pocket to buy advertising time in Iowa and New Hampshire. It's actually begun to pay off. According to Politico, I'm looking at a Politico article from day before yesterday. It says that an internal poll from Iowa ranks him fifth in terms of name identification among all potential Democratic candidates. 52% of likely Democratic caucus goers polled know who John Delaney is.
Wow.
And that puts him behind only Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Cory Booker. It puts him ahead of Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, and Terry McAuliffe.
That is amazing.
I think it's incredible.
That really is amazing. Now, that's great for what we've always talked about, the power of needing to campaign and the need to have money behind candidates who are campaigning for name recognition.
Yeah, it's all about the money.
Yeah, but when you get into campaigning, then people are going to start looking at his record.
Yeah.
And the fact that he made his money from commercial lending.
Yeah, they may not like that.
That's iffy.
We have to end it there. We were joined here in the studio by Jacqueline Lukman. Jacqueline's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can listen to Lukman Nation's live stream every Thursday night at 9 o'clock on Facebook. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.